One thing I did want to ask you was, when you were doing your survey, did you go around the town doing it?
Yes, the whole bottom is very large. I've got an untidy collection. If I need to go.
Yes.
Very mild, and they were very friendly. They were mostly, the secretaries were mostly elderly men, and they didn't mind the young woman properly introduced and allowed to talk to them.
How were you introduced to the trade union leaders?
I can't remember. I think it was Dr. Carlyle probably at the beginning. He was he was a great friend of trade unionists, as they were.
Yes.
I think so.
Yes.
Here are notes.
How you got in touch with these trade union leaders? Did you see very many of them?
There weren't very many, though, about a dozen, I think, there were trade unions at the time. Some of them were small, and either I or Dr. Carlyle wrote a letter to say, could I come and talk to him, as far as I recollect. I think he told me to quote him.
Did he? He said you could use his name.
He was very friendly about it. He was one of the few people who are positively helping anything industrial.
You mean not just agitating, but actually doing practical things of a day-to-day sort?
I think so, yes.
So if he gave you a recommendation, then you would get well received,
yes,
would you?
Yes, they were perfectly ready to talk, all of them. Well, got to see them at the right time.
What sort of things did you want to ask them, really?
I think I asked them about wages, chiefly.
Yes.
And apprenticeship. Learning
between. Yes. You were interested in, you started off your investigation in a way through looking at apprenticeship, didn't you? That's what started you off, wasn't it, really? Because you did.
Yes. I helped with that. Yes.
I mean, you did a research into boys, young boys, didn't you?
Yes, There was this society which was founded for a short time in 1906 or 7 or 8, I forget when, then the Council for Industrial Advancement of Young People in Oxford. That was its brief title, to help to get boys and girls properly trained. And it was run by all things that one knew of helping development in the town was started by university people, I think, at that period. That's my impression. This was done by Deniston, Mrs. Deniston, was his mother, who was a secretary, but I helped her there. And we used to, I've got a whole box down below of notes about training.
Have you really?
Different people. Rather short, but I've got more there.
That would interest me a lot if I could look at that sometime, if you can hunt it out.
Yes, you wouldn't find it very, very interesting, really, because we seem to put very short things on. I've got a whole book of correspondence about it.
Yes.
Employers weren't always as welcoming as the trade unionists were, remember. Somebody, we were trying to get him apprenticed for organ building, very unusual thing, but it was a good man who did it in East Oxford. And he wrote a letter finally back to Mrs. Denison. Several people had been to ask him about his work and about a particular boy. And he wrote rather firmly and said he would try the boy, but he did hope there wouldn't be so many ladies coming to ask him questions or works of that effect.
That's interesting, because on the whole, in your survey, you got quite a lot of help from employers, didn't you?
Yes. They were all quite friendly. People were friendly at that period. I mean,
some of the early social surveyors had great trouble with employers. They just thought that they were going to try and make difficulties with their employees and so on.
Yes, I expect that was it. Well, you see, I don't think who... Of course, there were building trades. But, I mean, there were one or two strikes, of course, just about that time, but very seldom. What was the one that... Just before the war. GDH Corps helped it.
Wasn't there a transport strike? Uh-huh. A bus, transport
yes,
strike?
Yes, it was. There wasn't a bus.
Tram sort of employees.
Or was it builders?
I'm not sure.
No.
Anyway,
well, this is, yes.
Strikes were not very frequent in
no,
Oxford.
No, not at all frequent. And, I mean, I think the builders, the trade unionists, would always have been the minority, I think, in all their trades, I think. I don't think the shoemakers were, being small, they may have had full members. I rather think the masons, who were a very superior body, of course, in there, I rather think they had a strong trade union.
Did they? Yes, yes.
Didn't do them much good, of course. They came in for the first out-of-work unemployment allowances, didn't they, when the war broke up, the
yes.
First war. I remember I was helping then to run the relief committee then, and very respectable trade unionists, masons, came up saying they, of course, their work had stopped quite completely. And they were now entitled to get 7 shillings a week from the state. But really, they couldn't live upon 7 shillings a week with their families, could they? They did so hate our scheme because they were so such very admirable, self-respecting people.
Yes, yes. Of course, all these trades, these trade unionists were in elite trades, weren't they? I mean, in the craft trades, really, or were there some
yes.
Ordinary general labourers, trade unionists?
I don't think there was anything. Workers' union, I don't think so. They all grew up during, really came to anything of value during the First World War.
But a lot of your concern in your survey is really to support or hold up the respectability of the better type of working person, isn't it? I mean, it's essential to your whole survey, really, the distinction between the respectable working person and the unrespectable. Isn't that so?
Not respectable, I think, but well off or poor.
Yes.
Or really poor. I don't think we worried very much about, I mean, the COS did like people, they helped people who are respectable. In a sensible, and very sensibly, not at all, in a sensible way they were there. But I think we were more concerned, the people that I had to do with, are much more concerned with whether they were well enough off to lead a reasonable life or whether they were very poor. I mean, living on the 20 shillings a week level, don't you know, for the family, that kind of thing. Mm. And the unskilled labourers, of course, were very poor. Their wives went out to work, not full time, or took in work to do their. Mm. They were thankful, and their children were thankful to get away to school, from the school by 13 and a half if they could disregard the law and do it. They were very poor. Of course, they were the people who had the lower standard of bringing up babies of their small children, and they were the people who were so specially helped by Mrs. Fisher and Mrs. Wells and Mrs. Pritchard and Mrs. Ayles Smith, those four people particularly, when they got started in 1903, wasn't it, or 1904, the voluntary Child Infant Welfare, I can't remember its name, but it got its books next door,
yes.
Society there.
Yes.
And they blossomed forth into starting Cottage Improvement Society. No, that had started a long time before, but it
was
started
sort of revived.
About
Deja
Hill, very yes. connecting to see one side of it. Mm. But the end, it went on. Until it was the perfect illustration, the infant welfare business there, that I think I told you I had to do with chiefly because it was the first thing I was allowed to rule lines for their record books.
Yeah, yes, I remember.
But it was a perfect illustration of statutory voluntary
yes.
cooperation.
Mm.
It wasn't done, taken over by the state to begin with, but there was a friendly early relationship with the very good medical officer of health of the time, that he would report to the secretary the birth of any babies, and would back up visiting and
so
infant welfare centres for them.
Mm. In a way, that's the way your whole life's been spent, Miss Butler, isn't it? On the sort of margin between public and voluntary
yes, very
aid,
much, yes.
isn't it?
Generally, you know, it's interesting to see how it has changed, but generally speaking, it was the voluntary societies, the voluntary groups that did the pioneer work quite steadily. Certainly in Oxford, or particularly because the local authorities were pretty, the local authority was very somnolent. It did what it had got to do, but it was up till the First World War, then it woke up and it developed very much afterwards. There, it had exceptions, it had to go to MOH, but otherwise it was slow. But more and more it's been going back. The pioneer work was done by the voluntary societies and very largely by university members.
Yes, yes,
yeah.
That's true. I mean, one of the things that I notice in this book is that you have quite a strong opinion that the university has obligations to the surrounding community.
Yes, quite.
And that this book, in a way, is a response to that belief. Is that right? Do you think?
I think so. Yes.
And this goes right back to T.H. Green, doesn't it? Via Scott Holland.
It was pushed on. It came on, developed very much. It was yes. The recognition of responsibility came partly, I suppose, from. Oh, I don't know where it came. It really came from the religious denominations, largely, you know, of different kinds to begin with. It also came from the progressive liberals there of the 60s, 70s, 80s of last century, coming on into the beginning of this of last century, 19, this century there. It was partly from them, and it was partly good politicians, you see, was caring for the individual, the liberal there, and partly people like the Christian Social Union people. No, people like Dale Sidney Ball, because he approached and he helped with pushing things from the good socialist point of view. Not the, I think, the, I don't mean he was irreligious, but not from the religious point of view, I think.
Because you yes. knew Sidney Ball quite well,
yes.
didn't you?
He was a very affectionate pupil of my father's, and he was always very kind to me there, therefore. You'll find, have you read his life?
Sidney Ball's life, yes,
yes
I have. There's a memoir of your father in the back.
Yes, quite.
There?
Yes. There.
Was Sidney Ball keen on your survey? I mean, did he show an interest in it?
Not particularly, I think. it all got somehow, it was launched too late in 1912, and we somehow all got so absorbed in thinking about the war coming on, the war. That period. He was very kind to me always, and when I was half the big bonnet house, you see it, I started, yeah, you don't want all my an exciting my autobiography, but I began, I forget when I became a tutor, a recognised tutor, or at home students, St. Agnes, somehow about, I think, dear Mrs. Johnson sent me a postcard and said, wouldn't I like to be one there, somewhere about 1912 or 13. And I began was to be a tutor to a caretaker of any social training students who came on as a bonnet house, who joined into a bonnet house when it was started late in 1913, I think. Dr. Carlyle met me outside the Dragon School in the Dragon Lane one day, and he said, wouldn't you like to, we think there's a few women students going to come along, will you look after them? Well, it was that I never was asked, after the war, took it all over. I mean, that was it. But I mean, those were both very kind. A.J. Carlyle, they both of them, you see, were socialists of sorts. Yeah. And they, one of them definitely was doing it very much from the Christian side point of view, the other one. But from the marketing point of view, look, you haven't got your machine talking to me about marketing.
Should you like it off for the moment?
Yep, for the moment.
He almost established Barnett House, really,
yes.
Didn't he?
Yes.
Yes,
but he and Dr. Adams.
He was unusual in teaching Marx in Oxford at that time, wasn't he?
Well, I selected, there was a diploma in economics. I was very young then, and I said I'd like to do it after a short gap after finishing history schools. And I was not allowed to choose, it had two special subjects. And I chose the poor law and socialists, and enjoyed them very much. And worked Sydney Ball, I remember making out a scheme, and I just did them quite peacefully by myself, with an occasional conversation with somebody. And
with Sydney Ball, in fact.
With Sydney Ball for the socialists, and anybody else with the poor law. Yes.
Do you think Sidney Ball was an important influence on you at that time, or not, really?
I rather doubt whether he was. But I don't know. I don't think... But I don't really know.
I mean,
socialism wasn't strong at that period, and he wasn't only a socialist at all. He was a very gentle kind of Fabian.
He must have taken an interest in you as your father's daughter.
Yes, mm-hmm. I think it was chiefly that to begin with. There.
Well, I mean, that would be part of it anyway, wouldn't
yes,
it?
Yes, quite.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes.
He was always very kind. Yeah.
But he was a great undergraduate tutor, wasn't he? I hadn't realised how...
Oh, yes, very much. I'm sure he influenced them very much. Mm. But quite as much. I don't think he probably turned them into socialists very especially. I've no doubt he had, but then I don't... It would have been inside... Wadham, wouldn't it, if at all? Wadham, St. John's.
St. John's, yes.
Yes.
Yes. He taught you anyway for the socialist, the socialist option, really, the socialist theorist.
Yes, quite.
Yes. So what did you do, Marx? Bernstein, did you?
I don't remember now. I had a good many of them.
Yes.
Later.
It sounds a rather good course.
Yes, quite.
I would have thought.
Yes.
I wish we had it now. But were you actually a member of the CSU, Miss Butler?
No, I don't think I was. I don't quite know why I wasn't. No.
And it represents your sort of views?
Yes.
In a way, does it?
Yes.
Because I read a biography of Scott Holland by Paget, after I met you last time. Mm-hmm. And I found his letters and his writing rather cloudy, rather insubstantial in a way, though elegant, you know.
He talked too much. He said too much. He couldn't say things tersely. That's what I mean.
Yes, yes.
But as a personality, he was a delightful person.
Was he?
Very good. Yes, delightful.
Because he comes over quite as a charming bachelor who obviously attracted a lot of people, but it's difficult to see why now. Really?
He was very keen and very enthusiastic. Wait a minute. There's a very nice... I forget what the two adjectives to him in the monument and the cathedral. They were just describe him exactly right.
I'll go and have a look.
They're just on the other... When you come into the cathedral and... you're going up. On the left-hand side, I'm not quite there. It's just quite near the beginning of the chancel. Not in the chancel, but just at the side. Yeah, I seem to have no vocabulary left, but you'll find him there to be seen. Rather high up.
I'll have a look, yes.
Yeah.
Did you see very much of him yourself?
No. He was getting old then, when he died in the war during the didn't he?
That's
yes.
Right.
Mm. The last thing that I heard of him was his sending around £20, which quite meant, I think it was that, to the relief committee, which I was running with Mrs. Bishop in the town hall there, to buy materials for. By wool for some of the out of work women who we were helping to make do knitting for the sake of self. It was just, he had that kind of idea there. And he was one of them. And I liked him because he liked practical things. They're carrying on them.
As you do. Yes, it's interesting. But he was obviously a very influential figure who now is quite forgotten, I think, or relatively forgotten.
Yeah, I think the Christian Social Union would be quite... No. What would it have gone on into? I remember being asked after... Now, when was it? I think it was only after this war, last war, I mean, that some undergraduate society asked me to come and talk to them about the Christian Social Union. They just heard its name and they wanted to know a little more about it. I think they weren't very much interested, but they are.
Was your father in it?
No, I don't think he was. He wouldn't have been against it, I think. I forget what date it got started. Somewhere in the late 20s. Well, he was very much occupied with many other things. I mean, he would have cared very much. But didn't join societies very much there at that time. If you want, there's no reason why you should want to know anything about my father that I could really at all. But if you want to read about him, there was a quite particularly nice obituary notice of him in the Times when he died.
Oh, well, I'll make...
And it gives you a little bit of a picture of... It says something rather sensible about the Oxford Liberals. Father, In the Times, it was 2 days after he died. It was January 18, 1909, if you think it's worth your while.
I certainly think it is worth
it. If you don't want to, you did say you wanted. I nearly brought it back for you when I was talking to my sister, who's got a collection of them. She's now in one of those nice flats, you know, in the Plantation Road. But it was raining so very hard that I didn't bring it back.
Yeah.
But if you like to call or call now and ask to see it, don't let her begin to talk too long, she'll get tired.
Yes. Yeah,
but she, you could take it away if you promised to bring it back.
Yes,
it might be less trouble than looking.
Yes.
There's a thing in the head of your bin. It might be less trouble. I think it would give you a little background if it's Oxford, which was.
Yes, it would, I'm sure.
But it's much more important. I mean, don't think about it. Have as little about me. I don't know what you're going to write. Have as little about me as possible, do you see?
Yes. Now, I think, you know, your father would be very interesting. Did he have this feeling that the university had great obligations to the town?
I think he had, quite definitely, yes, quite definitely. But he was, when he came back to be a fellow of Oriel after being ill, he was vice provost for a bit, and he was chaplain, and he was a senior fellow and all that kind of thing, and he was very much occupied with undergraduates. He loved them, and they loved him very much, you see. So he didn't do, also he was getting married, and therefore he didn't do a great deal of outside things, but he remained faithfully supporting the cottage improvement, the housing, and a limited number of things of that kind there, and backing other university attempts to help Oxford.
Of course, Oxford was so much smaller then anyway, wasn't it, that it was easy for the university to do quite a lot, really,
quite.
In the community.
Quite. And easy to get public opinion about things, too, because everybody knew everybody, really, I mean, in the university, more or less, so much of the senior fellows.
And they were the only distinguished people in the town, really, the university people, weren't they? I mean, there wasn't a town that had a separate life.
No.
With its own distinguished people at all?
Well, no. At least it wasn't that kind to them sometimes.
I mean, the university was the main source of employment through the press and through the colleges, so that the university heads and so on could do quite
yes.
a lot locally.
Yes, quite. And the press did send, I'm sure the press set up high standards of work and of relations. They never had any, that's my impression, they never had any trouble in their industrial relations until quite a few years ago. Yeah, that's not a statement, but that's my impression.
Yes, yes. But your father was also a sort of country vicar, wasn't he, in Birdlip, in a sense?
He wasn't a country vicar.
I mean, didn't he take a part in Birdlip city village life?
So far as he was up there, but that was only in holidays that you see there.
I see, yes. He didn't.
He would have. He preached sermons to them, nice sermons to them at intervals.
They had their own vicar as well, I suppose, didn't they?
Well, not actually for Birdlip village. He didn't have. Oh, as he did, shared with the next village. There was small villages, all those called salt villages. Pretty small, because they hadn't enough water to be large.
Mm-hmm.
They lived upon precarious pumps.
Mm-hmm. But he would give sermons there, would he? When he went up there.
Oh, he was great friends with the village there. Oh, God. Great friends. I can see him now preaching from a farm cart at the annual friendly society do on the common.
Those friendly society festivals were very important, weren't they?
Oh, very important indeed. Very. Quite. He had a green ribbon diagonally across his chest, and all the higher foresters and courts of old people had different kinds of ribbons. And beautiful. They had a march up from the village, headed the village policeman, and two bands. which had an unfortunate habit of playing different tunes at the same time, but they all felt very happy about it there. And they had people came back, all their sons and daughters from distance came back. It was a great village festival altogether there.
Most villages had those.
They mostly had them.
Yes. That would be in the 1880s, would it, or 1890s?
Oh, it went right on into... it went on up to the war, up to 1914, as far as I recollect.
Yes, I was just thinking of that incident that you remember, where your father spoke.
Oh, that would be... I should think it would be late 90s.
Hmm.
Or just the Shortly beginning, or just the beginning of 1900, yes.
Yes. Yes.
The poor beds there. No, it was a little later, about 1910, I think, when the local clergyman who was there, a couple of local clergymen generally came. The two beds, I don't know if you know the hymn, Count Your Blessings.
Yes.
Yes. Well, they were very fond of having Count Your Blessings, but unfortunately, one of the bands played a different tune. They played them very hard. One half of the congregation played the same one way. I don't know if it was the foresters, the arts of oak or what it was, but the result was unfortunate. And the one musical clergyman who was visited, he would not have hearts Count Your Blessings ever again. And he was very careful about which bands they had.
Could you tell me a bit about the LMH settlement? I didn't quite understand. Your father was connected with it, wasn't he?
Oh, no. he was a member of the council almost from the beginning.
You mean of LMH council?
LMH, yes. There. I think it was the second. Almost from the beginning. I think Mr. Spooner, whose daughter I was seeing at great lengths yesterday. He started in the first term, and my father started in the second term, I think, on their council. And the council, when it was decided they'd like to have a settlement, the council, of course, was consulted and approved. That was all very much, and he backed it up. He did.
He wasn't
again
personally identified with it very much. It was just that he lent his support.
Yes, it was all there.
Mm.
And it came, though, that they saw the crop of settlements. Well, of course, it began with 84, but then the women's settlements began in the 90s, isn't they? Late 90s, I think. I ought to have the exact date of the...
Well, they certainly were in existence then, yes. Yes. Because I quite often find with the suffragettes, I'm interviewing a lot of former suffragettes, and very often, or suffragists, and very often they start off in a settlement.
Quite so, yes.
And then they get interested in women's questions that way, you see.
Yes, quite.
Kathleen Courtney was one of those.
Yes, I know she had something to do with the LMH settlement. I'm pretty sure
Lambeth.
She had.
In Lambeth, wasn't it?
Yes, in Lambeth. It is still.
Yes.
Yes, they've all gone through ups and downs. There.
Yes. So your father didn't personally do very much, but he sent his daughter, didn't he, to the settlement?
Yes, father. It got started. Yes.
I mean, Olive went there...
She went there in about 1909. She'd been there earlier, I think. She went his full approval for a bit. I mean, see what it was like somewhere about 1904 or 1903 or so, I think. And we made friends then. And went there steadily somewhere about 1910. And then...
Continuously until
then she went away. She went away during the war and did the work, partly industrial welfare and partly in France, and then came back. It was there till 1936 that she was warden for about 12 years part of the time. And it was very nice, happy, cheerful, and good place. Very Christian, but without thrusting Christianity upon people at all.
Why didn't you go there yourself?
When?
Why didn't you go there yourself?
Oh, 'cause I wanted to. Partly I wanted to help people, and partly I was so interested I wanted to see what it was like.
No, what I meant was, why didn't you go there like your sister Olive and stay there for a long time? I mean, you only went there briefly, didn't you?
Yes.
Did you ever think of spending long...
I went back a good many times to do short bits of work there.
But Olive spent much more of her...
Oh, yes, she did, very full time indeed, yes. Mm. Well, I was so interested in the Oxford, I got more tied up in the Oxford things than she had. She went there.
One person who I hear mentioned a lot is Mrs. T.H. Green. She was still alive, wasn't she, when, at that time?
Oh, yes, dear Mrs. T.H. Green. Do you know what she looked like? I have
no.
A number of pictures of her next door. Shall I bring you one?
I'd love one. Or shall I go and get it?
No, it fits.
Yes,
she has that.
Very determined.
T.H. Green was one of the university people who was responsible for the boys' school.
Yes.
High school there. And when after... She went on, she did a great deal for nursing in Oxford, but she went on to the, was one of the first women co-opted under the 1902 Act, after the City Education Committee. Yeah. She was combined very much, very well, being very much interested in women's education and helping with women's education.
Did you know her very well?
Yes, quite well. She was a great friend of my mother and of Mrs. Johnson. And I was trying to find the picture of her.
So she was one of those university people who had a feeling of obligation to the town?
I think very definitely, yes. There was this nice picture of Mrs. Johnson and Mrs. Toynbee, Mrs. Arnold Toynbee, and they were great, and Mrs. T.H. Green. They were a great trio.
They were a trio when you were a young woman. Were they active in...
Well, not. They were always very middle-aged to elderly people when I knew them. Yeah, all of them, but they were very keen and they did help. They weren't yet very young, any of them, I think, when they began to take up work of this kind, I mean outside work. Yeah. Not like the trio that I'm talking of Mrs. Fisher and Mrs. Pritchard and Mrs. Wells. The other trio who helped with starting the women's colleges, all of the rest of it, yeah. Were older people with more definite experience.
Did Mrs. Green influence you very much, do you think? I mean, did you admire her, or...
Which?
Did Mrs. Green influence you very much?
That had very much, yes.
Because she was socially... She had a social conscience and
very much of a social conscience.
Mm.
And, very high-minded. Delightful person. She trained as a nurse, you know, after her husband died. I bet she was very good about health, caring for health. Yeah, she was a delightful person.
In a way, she carries on her husband's ideals.
Yes, quite.
Yes. That's interesting.
Sibbons.
One thing that struck me rather, when you were talking to me last time, was your periods of boredom as a young woman. Bored. You said you were very bored.
Well, after doing, just having finished doing schools.
Yes.
Quite.
Was this just because there was so little for an educated woman to do at that time? Or,
I mean...
Do you feel, I mean...
Well, it was just reaction. I didn't know what I wanted to do next. I think that was... There weren't, of course, very many occupations, really, except for the particularly adventurous people. I wasn't particularly adventurous at all there. I was quite sure I didn't want to be a schoolmistress. It was negative there. And, well, there weren't merely... I mean, nowadays, the modern young woman, of course, has 50 things ready for her at once, and there were only two or three things at that time. It didn't last very long, because I found something about the more voluntary things to do, don't you know?
But you also had a period of boredom before you went up to university as well, didn't you? You said you finished school and you didn't...
Yes.
You were bored.
Looking out, yes, quite.
Yes, I mean, I suppose you didn't know what direction your life was going to take, did you?
Oh, I think many people don't know.
No.
It must be a great comfort when they know, but many people, young people, young people don't know what they want to do.
It was very interesting. I was talking to a suffragette the other day, Grace Rowe, in Tunbridge Wells, who was forcibly fed in 1914, and she was quite different from you. She said she knew she had some mission
to
perform all through from childhood onward,
yes.
So she wasn't sure what it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she found the suffragette movement very fulfilling and so on.
Yes,
but,
quite.
You were never in that sort of position at all, really, were you?
No. I always wanted to help in some kind of social service, quite definitely, but it was rather difficult what kind of what was wanted.
Mm.
That is why I'm so thankful when I was allowed to, as I say, to all the exercise books, just after the record books, just after that we were finishing schools. It was only for about a term that I suffered acutely.
It must be very frustrating if you have a lot of talent or intelligence and you can't use it for any purpose.
Yes.
And it must be most exasperating.
But still...
Although in your family that problem would be less serious than in many.
Quite, yes.
Hmm. Supposing the First World War hadn't happened... Supposing the First World War hadn't happened, would you have gone on doing other social surveys, do you think?
No, I don't think so.
It was a once-for-all thing, really, was it?
I think so.
Because you were involved in teaching, of course, by 1914, weren't you? So that was your...
Just beginning then I was away doing other things during the war.
Mm. I was really wondering how far the war diverted your career, sort of thing. Whether it might have taken a different course, but for the war.
Oh, I think it would probably have taken a different course. Right, I don't know at all. But it did change the world so quite completely. I mean, even more than the last war.
I can believe that, yes. Mm. Yes. But I was wondering, you see, whether you might have done other social surveys in the 20s and 30s and become really a sort of sociologist rather than...
Yes, quite.
What did happen? But I suppose it's difficult to say, isn't it?
Most young Barnett House was very intelligent about social questions, and... Many people did that sort of thing. Kept one up very much in social problems.
In a way, your survey's a dead end in your life, isn't it? I mean, well, in the sense that it didn't lead to anything, did it, or did it, in your life?
No, I suppose it probably led to my... getting into being asked to help his bonnet house, I think, probably.
Did he?
So that I went on, you see, always being a pluralist. I mean, whatever you are when you're two things, being half tutors in deadness, you see, and half, oh, they've got to be good in more than half the social studies side, the social training side of Bonnet House.
So it's important in your life in that way,
yes,
in getting you an entree, so to speak.
Yes.
But not directly, in the sense that you didn't follow it up by doing other social surveys later, except your domestic service,
yes,
thing, which you'd already started on. So in a way it has got a position in your life, but
I never had always wanted to go on doing more, but I was always so very much occupied, and partly it was family things also too, and there which were apt to be rather absorbing, so there in theory I helped with the, you know, the big final Bonnet House survey that was at the end of this war, the last war, there. That's a long way on. But I hadn't time really to do the survey work.
When you say in theory you helped, what did you do?
Well, I didn't do very much really there. You know, I mean, I knew about a good many. I helped some of the people who had time to do the practical work.
I haven't read them.
I produced a tract for the Ministry of Education called Village Survey Making. That is survey making. Surveys. And I had a gathering. That was from about 26 up to the first, up to the war, the 19th, the last war there. A proud author of pamphlet number 60, I think, of the Board of Education, teaching very nice society of head teachers who used to come in to me at Bonnet House, and I taught them how to make surveys, and make their children make surveys of their villages there now. Couldn't have heard anything more innocent than that, but we were very happy indeed. They were very good. They did practical work. They taught their children. They were the best kind of old-fashioned teacher who really loved their children, and their children loved them. Masters and mistresses, both. The master, the best of the old masters, led forth an expedition of his children, his boys, with their oldest boots on, to clean out the village pond, which was full of tin cans there. That was their expedition work after doing survey work and finding out about history and how many pigs there were in the village, that kind of thing. What did the other one do particularly? Oh yes, the other one, it was the mistress then, they turned them into village policemen under the great pleasure of the real policeman, assistant policeman, and they collected all the rubbish of the village. You see, expression work. They did learn quite a lot about that.
So there's a line of continuity, isn't there, with your earlier work? There is a direct line of continuity with your earlier work. But the idea was to make surveys like your Oxford survey, only less professional, was it, of their villages?
Yes, their villages. So to get people to feel patriotic, local patriotism.
Local pride, yes.
That was it.
Mm. But the Barnet House survey you mentioned, I don't know of that. What's it called, actually?
It's in the corner there, I think. No, it's downstairs.
Is it?
It's two volumes of social surveys. If you really want to know, I'll fetch it from downstairs. It had two fat volumes about social problems and government. Oxford and the region. You just tried to find out about how far regional government, you see, it was forecasting these regional changes.
I see, yeah. Yes. It was...
And Radcliffe Maud, John Maud, had a lot to do with it. I have somewhere stuck away a draft that he made, or that he... Of, he was to have written the final summary of it in the third volume, only it was just, he got it underway in the beginning of September 1914. He then naturally disappeared to higher things. And it never was, the two volumes, but yeah, it was very good work.
It was after the Second World War, was it?
This no, before.
Before?
See, that was it. Before. It was got, it, started in 1937, I think, there. It had very good people in charge of it, very good indeed, with a both couple there doing it and specialising for different sections there. It was really awfully well done, and I had one volume out, and the second volume came out just at the beginning of the just after the beginning of the war. It was done with the published by the press, and the third summary was to be written by John Maud, as he was. I have his summary somewhere locked up there.
And you were... You
I
were
was doing nothing really, I only did, because I was excessively hard worked at that period there, which was such a boom of demand for social servants, social service people then. Also, was there. So, I mean, I made or helped with things about villages and so on. Oh, I didn't know anything very... I was on its committee and gave good advice, but I hadn't time to go out to do things much.
No, no. But you gave ideas about how it should be organised, did you? And you...
Yes, I gave ideas, but they had Professor Adams and such very good people doing in the background that... I wasn't at all, I didn't consider myself at all important, but it was a good piece of work.
But you thought about reprinting your survey?
Oh, yes, very much indeed. Because I taught people about local government largely, you see, by people there. And.
Only you said that it didn't come off, or you were thinking of reprinting it. Was it 50 years after?
Which
your Oxford survey?
Oh, I always hoped that I would have saved up quantities of material for it, but life became too much occupied at that period. Largely was home things, as well as work.
This was in the
No, I wasn't working. I had officially retired by that time, and I ought, like other people, they retired, ought to have written the book, oughtn't I? But somehow, well, home affairs were rather complicated all of that period there. And so I didn't.
I'm not saying you should have written a book. I'm just wondering why you didn't reprint it.
I quite meant to.
You were going to reprint it in an updated sort of version, were you, or with...
Yes, rather like the 40 years on, don't you know, send up Booz. I mean, in memory of Booz.
Yes.
The London survey.
You were going to do quite another survey, were you, or...
I wasn't quite sure whether it'd be another survey or whether I should want to do some careful appendices. Explaining for my own satisfaction how much I changed my opinion about half the things. It was rather an odd book, dare say.
I don't think it's odd at all. It's the most interesting and valuable book, I think. So now you don't think it will be reprinted now, but it might have been reprinted in the 1960s if you'd...
Possibly, yes, quite.
Because one of the troubles about women's situation, especially when you were young, is that they were landed with all these family responsibilities and duties, weren't they? I mean, the daughters had to look after the parents,
yes,
and so on. And I suppose your career has suffered a bit by that, hasn't it?
Only quite lately. No, not Not much, no, no. We were rather close together.
Yes, I mean, I'm putting it purely looking at it from a career point of view. I mean,
yes, quite.
Supposing you had wanted to have a career, family difficulties, family responsibilities make it difficult for a woman, or used to make it much more difficult for a woman than it would now, don't
yes.
they?
Yes. Also, there was all this voluntary work, you see, for people to do if they stayed at home. If they hadn't found themselves careers and weren't married, there was getting to be a real demand for voluntary work of different kinds, particularly with young people, for the young people who did stay at home.
So in a way, the society is organised on the assumption that there will be women at home doing family duties.
Yes. Partly doing family, yes, quite.
And so there are things organised for your spare time in that context, yes.
But I must suggest at all, I mean, family preoccupations came much later on, with the family, or family without having people ill at intervals, of course, that kind of thing, but not otherwise. Me, my sister and I were both sisters, and I, we were both left completely free by Anglo-Pagan parents to do what we wanted. I suppose all the crop of local surveys that came out about that period, they were just about the same period as my little book there. Yeah. He came. Well, there was a. It came partly, of course, I think it was a great shock, the report about health, or the nation state of health, and explanations about poverty there that came after the in the report after the First World War the Boer War. Then I think that shocked people very much indeed, and of course there was always the Booth report coming out in different cities before that and producing results, and I think that probably was one of the things that stirred people. Norwich, Cambridge, so on, all about the same time, to want to know more about what was happening in their own areas and to see what could be done to help them. I think that was just very much the background of the thing. Oh, yeah.
What inspired Mrs. Fisher, Mrs. Pritchard and Mrs. Wells? I mean, what made them so involved in local affairs, do you think? What was the inspiration, in a sense,
There was this wave, you see, of to raise the standards of the country going on, and I dare say, nowadays the young women, I know they want to help, and they do go out to do social service in the narrow sense now, don't they? But equally, they sit upon the steps of the tavern and building, don't they? I mean, they have one way of letting off steam. These were three. They were three delightful people. Mrs. Fisher couldn't find anybody more delightful than hers at that period.
What was she like as a tutor?
And Mrs. Pritchard had a very good first class in grades, the philosophy side, Mrs. Fisher, and dear Mrs. Wells, they were all such very nice people, and Mrs. Aylesmith, and you must know what Aylesmith so we want, but eight delightful children. And she so she knew all about babies, so she was the most admirable deficient helper of the infant welfare, as was starting infant welfare. They were all, yes.
What was Mrs. Fisher like as a tutor? Was she very critical of your work?
No, not very critical. She was generally rather encouraging. I used to stand under the lamppost opposite and read her polite remarks scribbled at the end of my essays. It was great pleasure. My impression of her, don't mention this to if you go to see her daughter. My impression both of them being very good teachers. They shared a room, a study room. He was out when one went, and there was always, by recollection, a basket full of kittens sitting in the middle of the room by the fireplace. It was a very great effort towards the study of economics.
It was economic history she taught you, really, wasn't it?
No, economic theory there.
Oh, was it?
All full of applications. She cared about it for applications.
I see, yes, yes. Because did she write anything, actually? I don't know anything about her career at all.
She wrote a very good little book called Then and Now. Wait a moment. I don't think she did write. No, she did. What was it? It was sort of. Yes, she did do one book. I think she was one of the first people. The magazine is called Zed and Now, isn't it?
Past and Present, you mean?
Past and Present, yes. Well, didn't she write something called Past and Present?
Did she, yes.
Something of that kind.
Of
that kind.
Yes.
But she wasn't a researcher. She was very much interested in human things, do you see it there?
So she was, of course she wasn't married when you were taught by her, was she?
Oh, yes.
Oh, she was. Oh, she, that's right, she wasn't a mother, was she, by that time?
No, no. Mrs. Bennett appeared rather later on there.
So she had plenty of time?
Yes, she had plenty of time, yeah.
And I imagine they had servants in that household.
Yes, quite. Yes.
So she was a good tutor, and also active in a sort of social responsibility in the town.
She did a great deal about the town, yes, quite about the babies in welfare. Yeah.
Hmm. You're very lucky to have had an inspiring tutor like that. I mean, that's very important in one's life, I think.
Yes.
But I must ask Mrs. Bennett more about her.
I think her daughter, well, of course her daughter, I know St. Hilda's likes her so much. Yeah. But she didn't do when they came back, you know, after the war, I get so confused between two wars, but when they came back in 1920 or so, after the war, and he ceased being, he became warden of New College, of course, didn't he?
Yes.
Then. Well, she didn't carry on. Most sensibly, she didn't carry on with the Oxford social service works. And she was very much occupied in mind with all the other work, other forms of social service in the country as a whole. There, she didn't. I didn't really see much of her after that period. She was very kind and inspiring in my youth. She was very young. Her father was an Ilbert, you know. He was Courtney Ilbert. The House of Commons, the chief clerk there.
Oh, yes. One thing I can't... You must forgive me for asking this, and you refuse to answer if you want to, but one thing I can't decide from everything you've told me is which way you voted in 1918, 1922, 1923, 1924, 1929, and so on. I couldn't tell you from what you've told me which way you'd vote.
Correct.
And yes. Would it be impersonal?
I've always had to vote. I know I've almost always voted for the person who's a personality. I didn't want to get in there. I think I voted for the... I think I dutifully voted for the... we won't talk about the person, but I think I've dutifully tended to vote for the party, not the person. I felt it was a very dull thing having a vote.
But you've had a vote since 1918, I suppose.
Yes.
That must have been your first vote,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Yes.
And in fact, you must have had two votes, haven't you? You
yes.
had a university vote
yes.
as well as a town
yes,
vote, didn't
right.
you?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. So you've always attached yourself to a party rather than to the actual candidate. You haven't been interested.
I always wanted to vote for the candidate, but I think it didn't coincide at all.
Because my guess would be, you see, my guess would be, from what you've told me, that you would be a liberal, really. Possibly
yes.
moving towards Labour, but I'm not really sure.
I voted Conservative. I haven't always voted the same way. I voted Conservative at intervals.
Hmm. So have I. I mean, I voted Conservative in 1959 and 1974, mm-hmm. the last one.
Mm-hmm.
But I voted Labour all the other times mm-hmm. in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Did you start off as a Liberal and then move towards Conservatism? Or have you really voted for all three parties at different times?
I think so. I haven't, yes. I don't think I voted Labour. I can't remember if I ever have. Depended very much upon... No, I think perhaps I'm wrong in saying that I've always thought about... Yes. I was thinking about the individual. Well, I haven't been a very good politician. At all, yeah.
No, am I. I just wondered, you know, how yes. your ideas moved in national politics as opposed to local social life and local social policy.
Oh, well, both. Yeah, I don't think it really makes very much, not very much. I've always been interested in the... I can't help being interested in the national politics, the effects upon legislation, and I've always been very much interested in social legislation of all kinds.
Mm.
I have stacks down below, effects of Parliament, which nobody would want. Yes. Oh, that's by the way.
Did you ever write a review of Mogi's book, actually?
Right.
Of Mogi's book? You remember we agreed in not liking
oh, yes.
it very much.
I was always rather... No. I think perhaps that was rather... which did he write? I didn't care about them.
It was called...
Yes, he did the one about the wall, didn't he?
No, not the cut of their walls. No, that was somebody else.
Yes.
I know the book you mean.
Hmm.
No, it's called Family and Neighbourhood, I think, or...
Yes.
It's Family and Neighbourhood in Oxford, I think it's called. Published about 1950, that sort
yes.
of time. And I wondered whether you'd actually written a review of it, because
no.
it is a sort of, in a way, it's a later version
yes.
of what you did.
Yes.
Though more limited in scope.
No, I think somewhere, I don't know how I missed it, I forget. I was very preoccupied with other things just then. I think I, yes.
Because I've read it and I found it much less interesting than your own thing, partly because your own thing works from the inside. You know all the people who run things in Oxford and you work out from there.
Yes.
Whereas he starts off by asking people their opinions on things, people who are not in the middle of running things in Oxford, purely ordinary people, about their attitudes and so on, which is less interesting as a indication of how the community works. I mean, in a sense, yours is an official survey, isn't it, in a way? It's not not paid for by the Oxford Council, but it is official in the sense that you know all the people who run things, mm-hmm. don't you? Mm-hmm. So they're very different books, really.
Yes. Well, I suppose I don't know why I somehow didn't take it, didn't read it at the right time. I know the work, I was rather preoccupied with, again, with some people not being well at that period, and I was re-establishing myself after we'd well, in this house and so on, after we'd separated things off. I was rather tiresomely occupied and with other things. And then the world outside was still being very interested, very interesting, wasn't it? And not that you know, in 1950.
Well, I remember that, actually, and we're getting into my lifetime now. Anyway, I think I must go off and read the things that you put in your...
It was only one of a crop of things I happened to be... I enjoyed doing it, and I was very much interested in it, and rather hoped it would be useful. I think all the little local surveys of that period, just before and just after, came from... It is just plain desire to help the country to develop itself better after the Boer War. I mean, there'd been these reports, there'd been the 1902 Education Act, and there'd been the report about the health of school, the health of the nation, and there'd been all the discussion about whether you should field school children or not, and all that kind of thing, don't you know? That crop of things. And I think the reports were done probably partly as a result and partly as a desire to help to deal with these troubles. I think it was mostly they were meant to be harmless studies to help to make things a bit better. I remember you asked me whether I read the Webbs. Of course I read the works of the Webbs and Measurement and Publicity. Yeah, it's a very good motto, and it was behind the minds of... We didn't use it then, that was what was behind the minds of the people who did these local things.
Measurement and publicity. Measurement and publicity.
It's a very good phrase. It comes, I forget which of the... It comes in, I've quoted it so very often. There, you see, measurement, you've got to be... Nowadays people measure so much, don't they? They do these very scientific inquiries, and they're very keen about publicity, and publicity happens. Well, these amateur things were secretly, at any rate, had measurement in their minds. They've got to find out about things, and then get somebody to take action, read them, and hope that somebody would take action.
You always had your Irish woman in mind, didn't you? Your next-door Irish woman as somebody who didn't like measurement, in a way, didn't you? I mean.
Oh, yeah, quite. Yes, she didn't want measurement, no, not at all. No, quite. But
but that measurement and publicity thing, I mean, was that a statement that was well-known then, or is it something the Webbs made afterwards?
I think the Webbs invented it. I can't remember which of their books, but I've used it so often. Is it the Measurement of Social Work one? That one, I forget. The
Methods of Social Study?
I forget which it's in, but it's in one of the. I've got them all down below. It's somewhere there.
And it was something that you read before you did the survey, was it?
No, since. Unconsciously, I think that's it. That was all.
Yes.
But you've got to find something out, and then somehow they get people to pay some attention and take some action. I think they were all definitely meant to be utilitarian, all of them, like booze.